Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In global health circles, 2016 will be remembered as the year of Zika, that heretofore little-known mosquito-borne virus that stumped the experts and grabbed the headlines. Zika eventually spread throughout Latin America and into parts of the United States, prompting aggressive mosquito control and travel advisories for pregnant women. Zika virus is known to cause birth defects such as underdeveloped heads and newborns. Now, the virus is no longer considered a global threat by the World Health Organization, but it is still doing harm. Joining us by phone is Zika researcher and assistant professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine, Helen Lazier. Welcome to the show, Helen.
Hi, nice to be here.
The World Health Organization declared an end to the global health emergency. What does that mean for travelers? I mean, is the problem over?
It certainly does not mean that the problem is over. What's changed is the emergency status of the Zika virus outbreak. This is still a virus that's circulating in areas of Latin America and the Caribbean, and definitely something travelers need to be aware of. What's happening now is that instead of the emergency situation that we had when Zika virus first appeared, now we're entering into a new normal where this is a virus that's circulating in these areas and something that people are going to need to be aware of continually.
So the emergency status, what was that for? Is because we didn't know, we didn't understand?
Yeah, Zika virus isn't a virus that's new to science. We've known about this virus for many decades, but it's not something that had caused large outbreaks before. And so it's not something that we knew much about clinically. There hadn't been very many human cases before. And its emergence in the Western Hemisphere was associated with new disease presentations that we hadn't seen previously. And so because of all of those unknowns, that's what brought about the emergency situation that was in place last year or throughout this past year.
Why didn't Zika ever become a major threat in the U.S.?
Well, for a few reasons. Although Zika virus can be spread by sexual contact and from a mother to her fetus, the primary way that Zika virus is transmitted is by mosquitoes. And of course, in the U.S., we do have some of the mosquitoes that can transmit Zika virus, but we have a lot of protections against mosquito-borne illnesses in the way that we live our lives. So, in general, Americans spend more time inside, in air conditioning, in places with good window screens, and so we have a lot less exposure to these mosquitoes. And as many areas of the country are experiencing this week, we also have winter, so that certainly helps us prevent year-long exposure to mosquito-borne illnesses. And Zika virus is transmitted by the same mosquitoes that transmit other viruses to people, viruses like dengue virus or chikungunya virus. And we know from these other viruses that it's possible for these to be transmitted in the U.S. We've had in the past areas of Florida and Texas where they've had local transmission of dengue and chikungunya. And so it's not surprising that in those very same areas, we've recently seen some local transmission of Zika virus in southern Florida and southern Texas as well.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Zika virus in 2016 and what changed and what didn't. It is no longer considered a world health emergency. My guest is Helen Lazier. She's a Zika researcher and assistant professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine. You've studied Zika long before it became a major health scare this year. How has research changed or evolved in finding a treatment for it?
Well, there's certainly been a phenomenal amount of research that's happened in the past year in response to this emerging disease and the importance of it, and particularly because this is a virus that we now know is able to spread from a mother to fetus and cause birth defects. This was not something that we had known prior to this year, prior to this current outbreak, and there's been a tremendous amount of research about that. There's also a number of groups that are working to develop vaccines for Zika virus. The idea would be then that women and all people could potentially be vaccinated to prevent Zika-associated birth defects. It'll take time for those vaccines to be ready, though.
When did the connection between the Zika virus and the birth defects become apparent? Or why did it, I guess
the timing is part of the why. And so Zika virus had been circulating in the Pacific Islands in years previously, and it was first detected in Brazil in early 2015. And the emergence of Zika virus in the Western Hemisphere isn't so surprising. We have lots of examples where viruses that are mosquito-borne viruses that circulated in Africa or Asia were then introduced to the Americas. This happened with chikungunya virus in 2013, dengue before that. So the introduction of Zika into the Western Hemisphere wasn't so surprising. What was surprising, though, was so this virus was first detected in Brazil in early 2015. And then in the fall of 2015, in northeastern Brazil, the very area where the Zika virus outbreak had started, there started to be a surge in cases of microcephaly, which is a severe birth defect where the fetal brain fails to develop fully. And since then, it's become clear that Zika virus is able to spread from a mother, an infected mother, to her fetus, and that if this happens, it's possible for this virus to cause a range of different birth defects. Microcephaly was the first one that was reported, probably because it has such a dramatic presentation. You can imagine that if you're a doctor in a hospital and you start seeing many of these cases, that would be really noteworthy and something people would really take note of. Since then, though, the number of conditions that we've learned can be caused by congenital Zika virus infection has grown. And because these children have only been observed for at most about a year, we're still just learning the full range of effects.
What other effects are you finding or that you can connect to Zika?
So there's a number of different neurological effects that happen. It seems to be that Zika virus is able to infect cells in the developing brain, and this causes damage to the developing brain. And in a severe case, this can result in microcephaly, where you have the brain fails to develop. But there's other neurological effects that can happen as well. And so a lot of these children have seizures. They've also seen vision problems and hearing loss. Many of the children have poor joint development because in order for the joints to form properly, the fetus has to be able to move around in the uterus. And mm-hmm. So when there's damage to the motor neurons, that prevents the joints from developing properly. And as these children grow, I suspect that unfortunately we're going to learn about additional effects as well.
What was your response when it became apparent that Zika could be transmitted sexually? I mean, that's sort of a tipping point in a way, or could be.
Yeah, I was certainly surprised. This isn't something that we see with other viruses that are related to Zika virus, and so it's quite unexpected. And so, you know, whenever you hear one report of something or two reports, you know, it's hard to know what to make of it. But I'd say at this point we have pretty good evidence that this is a virus that can be transmitted sexually. And I think we don't yet know why it is that Zika virus can be transmitted sexually, but other related viruses don't seem to be. And that's an area that my lab is interested in studying.
Like chikungunya and that sort of thing.
So chikungunya is actually not related to Zika virus. They're spread by the same mosquitoes,
gotcha.
But different viruses. So dengue virus is one that's closely related to Zika. Also viruses like West Nile virus or Japanese encephalitis virus.
And those are not spread sexually transmitted?
No, we have no evidence that that happens. And so the reason that we learned about sexual transmission of Zika virus is through travel-associated cases in the U.S. and Europe, areas where we wouldn't have expected there to be local mosquito transmission. And so what would happen would be that someone would travel to an area where Zika virus is circulating in, say, Latin America or the Caribbean. They'd return home to the U.S. or Europe and pass the virus on to their partner. And based on this happening in the winter in areas where there were not local mosquitoes transmitting the virus, the simplest explanation is that is the result of sexual transmission. And if we think of a virus like dengue that's related to Zika virus, dengue also circulates in the very same areas of Latin America and mm-hmm. the Caribbean where Zika virus is circulating. And we have many travel-associated cases of dengue as well. You know, we've had those for many years. And really no evidence when any of those very similar sorts of travel-associated cases have led to a chain of sexual transmission.
One of the tricky things about all of this is, of course, is that the Zika virus presents itself in adults is mostly a mild reaction to it.
Yeah, you know, I think when Zika virus first emerged in Latin America, it wasn't a huge cause for concern, right? You know, we have other examples where mosquito-borne viruses have moved into a new area, and, you know, it caused a fairly benign, self-limiting fever, less severe than dengue infection. And so it was the sort of thing that people who studied these viruses paid attention to, but wasn't, it certainly wasn't a global health emergency in and of itself. And so I think that's another reason that the ability of this virus to cause birth defects was quite surprising, was just that it wasn't something that we thought about as being a very serious infection.
When you look at the response to the Zika virus, do you think it was handled properly?
I am impressed at the speed at which scientific discoveries have been made about this virus. I think it's really remarkable how quickly we've gone from a virus that was very obscure and we knew very little about. And now there are still many unknowns remaining, but really how much we've learned in a year is quite extraordinary. What's been disappointing is the slow response from Congress to appropriate new funds to deal with this very important public health matter. Zika virus is especially challenging from a public health standpoint because you have a virus that's transmitted by mosquitoes. It's a congenital infection that causes birth defects, and it's also sexually transmitted. And those three modes of transmission require completely different sorts of public health responses, making this particularly challenging to deal with compared to many other public health issues.
And Congress still has not responded with funding?
There has been funding that has come through. The request was originally made in February, and it wasn't until fall that any new funds were appropriated. And even that was less than what was originally requested. These funds go towards some research to study about the virus, but mostly for public health measures as well as vaccine development, which is really important if we want to help control the ability of this virus to cause birth defects.
Are you concerned that if it's no longer a world health emergency, that Congress is going to be less inclined?
I'd like to think not. I think even if it's emergency status, if it's not formally an emergency anymore, that doesn't mean it's not important. And I'd certainly like to think that politics aside, we can all agree that being able to stop something that causes birth defects is very important.
So as far as treatments or vaccinations, you said it's going to be a while no matter what.
Mm-hmm. There's a number of vaccine approaches in development, and there's every reason to think that we'll be able to develop an effective Zika virus vaccine. We have good vaccines against other related viruses, and there are many different approaches in development right now. It's just something that takes time to come together.
Are you concerned at all, or is there any indication that something like Zika that can be sexually transmitted, unlike a lot of related viruses, that this is the beginning of some new generation of viruses?
I don't think there's any reason to think that specifically. I do think the idea of emerging viruses where we have viruses that are fairly obscure, we know they circulate in nature, but they haven't really caused major human outbreaks in the past.
Yeah.
The idea that these obscure viruses can then be introduced to new areas and set off outbreaks, that is something that I think this isn't the last example of. You know, we saw a couple of years ago in 2013, chikungunya virus was introduced to the Western Hemisphere, and that was after several years in which it had been spreading throughout Southeast Asia and even into Europe. In 2015 and 2016, we saw Zika virus, and there's every reason to think that there will be some new mosquito-borne virus in a few years from now. I think that underscores the need to have some basic level of research and understanding about a variety of different viruses so that when new outbreaks emerge, we have the tools in hand to be able to address them.
Why do they tend to emerge in less developed countries? And do you think that has an impact on our ability to deal with them in the future?
Well, in the case of mosquito-borne viruses in general, some of that just has to do with the areas of the world where these mosquitoes are prevalent and you have a high mosquito burden. And in terms of local public health infrastructures are very important for being able to deal with these outbreaks as they emerge. If we draw a parallel to, say, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, That was an area where mobilizing a response there was slower than would be ideal, in part because a lack of public health infrastructure on the ground there, as well as a variety of other causes. And so I think for the U.S., in many cases, we have the good fortune to be protected from a lot of these emerging infections, but that's not something to be complacent about. As we've seen, we can have local transmission of mosquito-borne viruses in the continental U.S., not to mention that there's a huge Zika virus outbreak happening in Puerto Rico. In terms of climate change, there's every reason to think that the geographic range of these mosquitoes would be expanding farther into the United States. And global travel is a reality, and so to think that the U.S. is somehow insulated from these events is foolish.
Helen Lazier, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks very much.
Helen Lazier is a Zika researcher and assistant professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Coming up, we're going to talk about emergency medicine. Emergency first aid, maybe, is the better way to put it. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Dr. Henry Heimlich, the surgeon credited for the life-saving Heimlich maneuver, died last week. According to his educational institute, the first aid technique has saved thousands of lives since it was first used in 1974. Of course, knowing how to respond to an emergency, such as when someone is choking, is important in any survival situation and can mean the difference between life and death. Joining us by phone is emergency medicine physician at Stanford University School of Medicine, Dr. Paul Auerbach. He's author of Medicine for the Outdoors, The Essential Guide to First Aid and Medical Emergencies, now in its seventh edition. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
The Heimlich maneuver was introduced in 1974. Is it still the most successful way to treat choking victims, or was it ever the most successful way?
Oh, I think it certainly was the most successful innovation that we've had for treating choking victims. So it's a good technique for that purpose, and it remains so.
Has it evolved over time, or is it basically the same thing that they introduced, 40-odd years ago?
It really hasn't changed much. So it's the same technique that was introduced 40 years ago.
Is it used in inappropriate situations? It's so familiar, just the name of it. Everyone's sort of familiar with it. I'm certainly not going to demonstrate it over the radio. But are there times when people use it thinking it's appropriate when it's not?
Really, the major time not to use it, the most common circumstance in which it's used where it's not appropriate and is even dangerous is when there's a drowning situation. The original suggestion was that because people who drown may swallow a large amount of water before they go unconscious or even passively have it enter their stomachs afterwards, when they were brought up, people recommended the Heimlich maneuver, and that was to empty the lungs of water, and there's no evidence that that occurs. So if you press on somebody's stomach when it's full of water or food, they may vomit. So that water would come up in the airway and potentially come up from the stomach and then potentially go back in the airway. So long answer, short answer now is not to be used routinely in a drowning situation.
And first, you have to be clear that somebody actually is choking, right?
That's the presumption. There are universal gestures that people refer to when people choke, such as clutching their throat, bulging eyes, turning blue or red, and appearing to be choking. And that's really when the Heimlich maneuver is used.
Is it the same? Is it used the same way for children and older people?
It's used the same way. There's a slight modification in the sense of the amount of force that's applied, and you have to be very careful with positioning. So, and that's very important for elders. Elders have demineralization, they lose calcium in their bones, so they may have fragile ribs and chest wall. So if you squeeze them around the chest instead of in the upper part of the stomach underneath the diaphragm, underneath the chest, and squeeze forcefully, you can break ribs.
Frankly, I'm afraid that I wouldn't know how to do it properly. I've never been trained at it. Is it something that you recommend people be trained at?
Absolutely. And in the book, and there are illustrations of how to do it. So it's something that can be taught in a class. It can be self-taught. And one doesn't need to do it with all the force that you would do it with in a real situation to learn how to properly position your hands, the motion that you'd go through. It's uncomfortable to have it done full force, as you might imagine,
yeah.
But can be life-saving. But there's no reason why people can't learn this.
The Heimlich maneuver is one first aid survival skill, but there are many that you address in your book, and it's kind of a Bible for people who are out in the wilderness and that sort of thing. But it's also a lot of common sense things that people should know, in their own home, right?
Absolutely, and the premise is that common things happen in the woods or on a dive trip or when you're out skiing just as commonly as they happen in an urban situation. So you can have a heart attack or stroke or splinter or burn or other common injury, and so it's important to know how to deal with all of those.
You talk about cleaning and dressing wounds.
Absolutely.
What's the ABCs of that?
Someone once said the solution to pollution is dilution, and so that is to clean a wound. The very first thing is to stop bleeding.
Uh-huh.
So bleeding can be catastrophic, and unfortunately we've seen that with recent domestic events such as the bombing at the Boston Marathon. So it's important to know how to deal with torrential bleeding, whether that be the initial response, which is pressure, whether it be pressure points, knowing where to apply pressure over arteries as they course underneath the skin, or applying tourniquets. In the old days, when I was growing up in medicine, tourniquets were a bit frowned upon because people were concerned that they might injure limbs. And what we know now, again, unfortunately, from battlefield experiences, is that they save lives. And so civilians should also know how to apply tourniquets, whether they be commercial tourniquets that they carry with them or improvising a tourniquet. I taught a course last summer nationwide to high school students, and we'll be doing this for middle school students this summer, in which we teach them how to manage bleeding up to and including tourniquets. After that, it's important to clean wounds, and soap. And there's nothing better than soap and water. So irrigating with tap water is perfectly sufficient. It's been proven in emergency departments that tap water irrigation is not dangerous, cleans wounds just as well as using sterile saline. So with the appropriate amount of pressure applied to the irrigant, the water through the wound and cleaning it, that's important. And then, of course, knowing when to seek help, knowing how to put on a dressing, how to use antiseptics and put on splints, all of that is well within the purview of laypersons.
Do you think we've kind of distanced ourselves from what we're able to do in recent times?
Not really. I think there's in the wilderness medicine outdoor health community, there's a surge of medical education. So whether that be through the National Outdoor Leadership School or Outward Bound or the Wilderness Medical Society or the Scouts, there's a lot of education that goes on. I think what people are commonly afraid of is liability. And there are Good Samaritan laws to protect people if they respond reasonably to a crisis. And so being prepared is very important, and you will have the opportunity to help your family, your friends, or someone you come upon in the street. I think it's very important education.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about first aid today with Dr. Paul Auerbach. He's an emergency medicine physician at Stanford University School of Medicine and author of Medicine for the Outdoors, The Essential Guide to First Aid and Medical Emergencies. If you have a question for Dr. Auerbach, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, just going back to the old idea of stopping the bleeding, I remember I cut it wasn't a vein, it was something big in my hand. It was
an artery
in my hand. And yeah. My husband was very calmly said, well, hold your hand above your heart.
That's helpful, but not as much for arterial bleeding. So the difference between an artery and a vein is an artery is under significant pressure.
Yeah.
It comes out of the left side of your heart. It's what you see pulsing, if you see blood pulsing. A vein,
yeah,
is blood returning to your heart. It's under much lower pressure. It can be quite brisk if it's a large artery, but it's not under the same pressure. Elevating a limb that's been cut is absolutely helpful. So there's no reason not to do it and some reason to do it. But if the bleeding is significant, it often won't be enough. So then you have to apply some sort of pressure to the wound.
Yeah. Staying calm under pressure, it's difficult in an emergency situation. How do you recommend approaching any emergency? Is there a chapter on that?
There's not a chapter on it, but at the beginning, I talk about getting yourself together when you first get there, looking at the scene and seeing what the problems are. So taking a step back for sometimes a few seconds and sometimes a little more if there's not a life-threatening injury or illness, making sure the scene is safe. So the number one responsibility is to make sure that nobody's in further danger. If somebody got hit in the head with a rock that fell off the side of a cliff, it's important to make sure that you're not standing or treating a victim right where more rocks will fall. That's a good example. Taking a step back, taking a deep breath, prioritizing what the most important issues are, and then addressing them in a sequential fashion. That takes some practice. Sometimes it takes a long time to learn that in a very intense environment like an emergency department or a disaster response scene, but it can be taught and it can be practiced.
A poll from the Adelphi University Center for Health Innovation revealed that 44% of U.S. adults don't have first aid kits and almost 50% of them lack emergency supplies for use in the event of an emergency. What should most people have ready to go, let's say in a car, for example?
That, I'll try and do the best I can with that.
Mm-hmm.
The first point is regarding the statistics.
Mm-hmm.
The statistics are that are a reflection of the fact that most people never think it's going to happen to them. I mean, people don't do preparedness very well. And the name of the game is injury prevention first, mm-hmm, and then preparedness in case it happens. There are many long lists of what to have in a first aid kit, but I'll use an example. If people are getting ready for winter storms and are going to be out in cars, there are lists of things that people should carry. And again, I apologize for mentioning it's in the book, but it is in there.
Sure.
So, for instance, I have a list of a vehicle cold weather survival kit, and it's 34 items long. Do I think that everybody will put together these extensive kits and have them in their cars driving up to Tahoe to go skiing? I would be surprised if I found 1 in 100 that were prepared. But for the people that do it, if they have the essential items, they're important. And they're not just medical things, they're survival items.
Like a flashlight, that kind of thing? Or
correct. So things like flashlight, waterproof matches, a first aid kit, spare doses of personal medications, a multi-tool, empty coffee cans for melting snow or sanitary purposes, a portable radio receiver, extra cables, flashlight, tire chains, snow shovel, plastic water jugs that are full in case you're stuck in your car signaling stuff, and duct tape, a full tank of gas. People don't think about that. So it's a long list, but if you wanted to have everything that the experts recommended, you'd be prepared for that. And once you're prepared, you're ready to go. So these are items that, you know, can fit in a reasonable size box, and you just have it in your car and you just leave it there.
Is the list longer for at home, or is it shorter because you're already at home and there's a lot of that stuff sort of laying around?
The list is longer or shorter depending on where you are.
Okay.
So if you're in a area that's prone to wildfires, then you need to have certain equipment items and plans made. If you're in an isolated location, then you would have many more items. If you were in an urban setting where you have the common things that most people have at home, which are reasonable first aid items, then it might be lower. But the important point is that it takes conscious preparation. And I myself have been guilty of going out into environments that were remote and getting there and thinking that I had everything and having not gone off the checklist and checked everything, said, oh, darn, I'm missing X, and mm-hmm. I could have used X.
According to the American Heart Association, effective CPR, that's cardiopulmonary resuscitation, provided immediately after a sudden cardiac arrest can double or triple the chance of survival, but only about a third of victims receive that kind of treatment. Are most Americans not just not trained to do it properly? I was trained in that, and I'm still afraid to do that.
Well, don't be afraid. If someone's going to otherwise die, you're probably not going to hurt them. The important item that is really changed the whole face of survival from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest are the automated external defibrillators. So those are absolutely essential in the workplace, in a home where someone might have a statistically high rate of suffering a cardiac arrest. So someone who had suffered a heart attack and had certain heart conditions following that, those devices are absolutely life-saving because they treat the most treatable arrhythmia, abnormal heart rhythm, which is ventricular fibrillation, from which someone can survive a cardiac arrest. After that, we're talking about CPR, which is the mechanism by which you maintain circulation to the brain and other vital organs until such time as the patient can be made stable in a medical scenario. And it's not that complex. Again, it's something that requires training. And I think the other point is if you learn something once and you never use it, or you sit in a classroom and you see it and you understand it, but you don't refresh on it, mm-hmm. You tend to forget stuff. And we're all the same. So it's all about muscle memory and doing things often enough, reading about them or practicing them often enough so that you can recall them in a critical situation. While it's great that, you know, I have it explained in the book, you probably won't have the book with you when you come on someone who's had a cardiac arrest. So that's something that has to be imprinted in a way that you can recall it when you need to use it.
But it really makes a difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
People not. Well, yep. Dr. Paul Auerbach, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you. Be safe. Have a good holiday, and I hope everybody has a lot of fun in a safe fashion in the outdoors. Thanks.
I was reading today. Someone said that their dad used to always put a box of Band-Aids in their stockings when they were kids. It made me think of you.
With three kids, I've gone through a lot of Band-Aids.
Yeah, right. Well, thanks, Leanne. We will continue Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 2017 is just a few weeks away, and for a lot of folks, a new year also means a fresh start to getting fit, The American College of Sports Medicine has published its annual survey fitness trend predictions for 2017, and topping the list for the second time is wearable technology. Joining us is President-elect of the American College of Sports Medicine and Associate Dean in the College of Education and Human Development at Georgia State University, Walter Thompson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Thank you very much for having us.
So the survey predicts that wearable technology will remain the top fitness trend in 2017. Can you define what we mean by wearable technology? Just the Fitbits of the world, the smartwatches, that sort of thing?
Well, it is precisely that. And we were a bit surprised to see wearable technology again ranked number one. It was first introduced onto the survey last year at number one. But if you're following the fitness industry and wearable technologies, you'll know that some of the early models were not quite as accurate as we had hoped. But the companies have really upped their game. And once again, for 2017, wearable technology is the number one trend in the fitness industry.
So it's a trend, but there are lots of trends. Does it work? Does it matter?
Well, it's a very good point, because it's a very important distinction between what's a fad and what is a trend. You know, at this time of the year, you can turn on any late-night infomercial and see what's proclaimed to be the next trend in the fitness industry, and everybody's got to have it, and it appears under our Christmas tree, and unfortunately, it's usually stored in the closet or under a bed by mid-March.
Mm-hmm.
But what wearable technology does is that it gives us a moment-by-moment and now very accurate way of monitoring our exercise and our exercise progression.
And that's important. The more we're aware of it, the more we pay attention to it?
It's very motivating. I remember giving a lecture not too long ago. It was a one-hour lecture, and at 30 minutes into my lecture, I heard all of these beeps and gongs going off in the audience of about 500 people, and people were standing up. And I thought they were standing up to leave. What was happening was that their watches were telling them it's time to stand up, and many of them did. So it's motivating. It does give us a very accurate way to monitor our exercise progression. And some of the new wearable technology now is actually predicting when we go into what's known as an energy deficit. Most of us are in an energy surplus because we eat too much and don't exercise enough. But now there's a whole bunch of research that's going on that looks at energy deficits, and it may be that these prolonged energy deficits, which this wearable technology can predict, actually increases our body weight and leads to obesity.
How do they pick up on energy deficit? What are they tracking there?
Right. So you have to input into either your wearable watch or on a smartphone or on a laptop or tablet, what you eat during the day, and then it will track your physical activity. This device will track your physical activity, therefore estimating the number of calories that you expend versus and against the number of calories that you've consumed. And when the expenditure exceeds how much you've eaten, that's termed the energy deficit. And your watch will actually tell you it's time to eat 100 calories or 200 calories. Very fascinating work.
Yeah. You know, a University of Pittsburgh study found that some people didn't lose very much weight with fitness trackers. A lot of people get a lot of benefit out of it. So what are you really shooting for with a fitness tracker? And what's the key to getting the most, to achieving that?
Yeah, the most important thing is to not just wear the wearable technology, but learn how to use it and use it appropriately. Unfortunately, some of these research projects will simply hand over an app or hand over a watch and say, you know, wear it and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you don't understand how it's used or how to use it properly, it's not unusual for people not to react to it and react to it in a positive way. But those studies that have shown that the effective use of a physical activity tracker, it really is effective, and particularly now in patients and clients that are overweight or obese.
So, number one, understand fully how it works.
That's right.
And then participate with it.
That's as important as the first point.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we, I mentioned this group of people who are all fitness enthusiasts, by the way, stood up. But there was another half of the group that didn't stand up that may or may not have been paying attention to their watch that was telling them to stand up or telling them it's time to go for a walk.
Mm-hmm. And so just do it. Just stand up. I, of course, sit for 2 hours every morning on my job, and I always make sure I get up in between. But sitting, they call it the new smoking, right?
Yeah, precisely. There's a lot of studies out there looking at not just sedentary behavior, but I do the same thing when I'm in my office. I start working on a project, and I look up, it's 2 or 3 hours later. And I wonder why I can't stand up. And,
and
that's precisely why, because I've been sitting in one position for 2 hours.
Exactly. We're talking about the American College of Sports Medicine's annual survey on fitness trend predictions for 2017. We've just been talking about wearable technology. My guest is Walter Thompson. He's president-elect of the American College of Sports Medicine. Next on the list is body weight training. How do you define that, and why is it so popular?
Interestingly, body weight training first appeared on the ACSM survey in about 2008 and 2009. And you remember back then, that was at the start of the national, if not international, recession.
I certainly do.
And sure, and it seemed like there were people who were leaving gyms because they were using their discretionary money to join the gym and to stay with the gym. So gyms and health clubs around the country, it doesn't matter if it was a commercial club, corporate club, or medical fitness center, they were all looking for low-expense ways to develop exercise programs that were fun and exciting at the same time. So they rediscovered body weight training. Body weight training is simply using your body weight as the intensities, not using barbells or hand weights or any other device other than using your own body weight. Now, since we've come out of the recession, an interesting thing has happened in that these clubs were very successful in packaging body weight training, so they stayed with it, and they're able to sell and resell, market and remarket this body weight training very successfully. So a low-cost delivery model that's attracting clients and patients into the gyms.
And we're talking about wall sits, push-ups, burpees, that kind of thing.
All of those things. Anytime you use your own body weight as a form of resistance.
High-intensity interval training, another trend that made the list. Can you describe, what that is called and what it looks like, in your everyday rec center?
Sure. High-intensity interval training are short bouts of exercise, typically between 30 seconds and 1 minute at a very high intensity, almost to a maximum level of effort, followed by a very short period of rest, usually again about 30 seconds to a minute, followed by another bout of high intensity exercise. Of course, there's variations of this, but it's a real high effort kind of exercise followed by a short rest period, and then that's repeated over and over again.
I find teachers doing a lot of that, like in my classes, boot camps and things like that. That's really, it's just growing in popularity.
It is growing in popularity.
What's good about it?
Well, there's been some suggestions. I should warn you, though. There's been some suggestions that with any kind of high-intensity effort, there's going to be an increase, or there may be an increase, incidence of injury, or at least the opportunity to have injury. I kind of liken these short bursts of activity to you or I driving on an interstate. We can drive at 90 miles per hour, high intensity, or we can drive at the speed limit, which would be a moderate or lower intensity effort. And there's a greater chance of us having an accident at 90 miles an hour than at the speed limit.
Okay.
But people still do it because of high-intensity interval training, there's a lot of great benefits.
What are those? Why is it good?
So we see with high-intensity interval training a much more rapid increase in physical fitness. That is, if we can stay away from injury. course, if you're injured, then you're going to be non-compliant and not being able to exercise at all.
Right.
But there's been a lot of positive research on high-intensity interval training. People are enjoying the successes without being injured, but just a little bit of a warning that, like driving your car at 90 miles per hour in interstate versus 55 miles per hour, there's probably a greater chance of having an injury.
It didn't make the top 20 fitness trends in 2014. The last 2 years it has. You think that's kind of this, again, this kind of hangover from the recession?
The high intensity interval training?
Yeah.
It may be.
Okay.
We'll have to see. It was first introduced just a couple of years ago on the survey. It was number one for 1 year, then dropped to number two for 2016. Now it's number three for 2017. Mm-hmm. We'll have to see what happens with the research studies that are going on now and the benefits of high intensity interval training and, quite frankly, the injury rate. So we'll have to keep mm-hmm. an eye on it. It may be here for a while, but because it's starting to decrease on our survey, we'll just have to keep a watch on it.
The survey named educated, certified, and experienced fitness professionals as a trend. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's really interesting, and you may remember when personal trainers were first introduced to us. Only the very rich and only movie stars seem to have a personal trainer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you and I can go into any gym anywhere and pay any amount of money for a personal trainer. You can go to a YMCA and it becomes part of your package,
mm-hmm.
Or you can hire your own personal trainer. So now everyone's got a personal trainer. So what's happened in the industry is that it is not only unregulated, but it's totally unregulated. So in the course of the conversation that you and I are having, Ann, we can get on the internet, and as long as we had a good credit card, in the course of our 15 or 20 minutes together, we could be certified by about six different organizations, certified personal trainer.
Mm.
And then this afternoon, you and I can go to downtown Columbus and hang a sign on a storefront and call ourselves certified personal trainers. What's happening, though, in the industry is that the professionals who are personal trainers want to make sure that if you're a personal trainer, you're trained, you're educated, and you're certified. Right now, there's about 260 certification organizations. Only a handful are accredited by the National Commission for Certifying Agencies, the NCCA.
Mm-hmm.
And your readers can download this article and read all about the NCCA. But they're a third-party accreditor, an independent accreditor, who accredits personal trainer certifications because they've met certain points that they have to make, certain thresholds, and create exams that are appropriate for personal trainers. So my word of caution to someone who is thinking about a New Year's resolution, which is about this time of year, seek out a personal trainer, but one who is got an education, someone with a bachelor's degree at least, in exercise science, someone who's certified by an organization accredited by the NCCA. And then one last thing about personal trainers. In this deregulation kind of atmosphere we find ourselves at federal level and mostly at the state level, it's unlikely that personal trainers will become licensed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a word of caution. Look for someone who is educated, someone who's certified by an NCCA accredited certification organization.
And what about asking for references?
Yeah, perfect. My dad was looking for someone to work for. That's the first thing I did. I started calling people in the community. What kind of reputation does this person have?
Mm-hmm.
And many people will be very honest with you.
Real quick, we're just about out of time. Health fitness for older adults. I remember when I figured out that actually the older I get, the more I have to exercise. It's a thing. Is the market changing to meet those needs?
Well, it is and it isn't. Some of the really smart commercial clubs are changing the format of their club between the hours of 9 in the morning and 11 in the morning, and then in the early afternoon, just so that they can cater to the older adult.
Hmm.
It's probably the older adult that has the discretionary money these days.
Well, thank you so much, Walter Thompson, for joining us today. I appreciate your insights.
It's my pleasure. Happy holidays to all your listeners.
We'll have a link to that article we talked about from the American College of Sports Medicine. Walter is president-elect of the American College of Sports Medicine. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.